Welcome back to Research Talk. My name's Emily Wild. I'm Engagement and Community Specialist at JISC. I'll be hosting this episode of the Research Talk podcast, looking at research culture and assessment. Today, I'm joined by Alex Freeman, creator of Octopus, and Simon Hetrick, chair of the Hidden Ref. In this episode, Simon and Alex will be talking about research assessment, why change is needed, and how this might be achieved. Alex, welcome. Would you like to say a little bit about yourself and introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Thank you very much for inviting me on this podcast. I'm really interested to talk to Simon about research assessment because, I mean, my background was really quite unusual for somebody who's ended up in a research group in that I made television programs for a living. And then I ended up leading this research group in Cambridge working on the communication of evidence. And really quite quickly started thinking about how are we actually communicating to each other as academics and hearing researchers talking about how they were having to frame their careers and their research around the way that they're being assessed, which is mainly through research papers and academic papers. And that really made me kind of think, are we doing the right things here? So that's where I'm coming from.
Thanks, Alex. Simon, would you like to introduce yourself now?
Of course. Thank you for having me on also. I think all the best people in research have like weird backgrounds. They have to spend a lot of time in explaining to each other. So I'm absolutely with Alex on this one. But so my background is I'm a laser physicist. I was an experimentalist in the lab building these things. I got an interest in software, ended up working with the Software Sustainability Institute. And in there, I started dealing with the policies around the fact that software is this vital research tool, but it was almost entirely overlooked by research. All of research uses software. Most of research ignores the importance of software. And that led me into thinking about the people who developed this software, so the research software engineers and then the careers that these people didn't have in research. And then it got me thinking about, well, how do we recognize things like software that are important to research but not recognized? And that led me to the Hidden Ref.
Thanks, Simon. So how about we get stuck into the conversation? I thought perhaps we could begin by sharing a little bit about what research assessment looks like at the moment.
It's a good question. I mean, Simon, do you actually want to start on this? Because you are probably a more active researcher than I am now, because my research group is quite applied. So research at a fundamental level isn't really what we are mainly doing. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of concerned about the way that research is assessed. What about your group?
Yeah, so we're very similar. So I am on the academic pathway within my university at Southampton, but we are not traditional researchers. I describe myself as an unusual academic. So I don't write papers and I don't teach. But we conduct some sort of primary research. We go out and we investigate communities and we find out how they work. But we're largely doing that for policymakers and for writing reports. And then the main thing that we do is look into the way that software is used in research and help researchers use it better so that it's reliable and reproducible. So I have a similar sort of background. I'm working in a research environment. I'm certainly working with research and I'm conducting some research, but I'm not what you'd see as a traditional academic. And I think when you come from that background, you start to see how research assessment is sort of focused on a very, very traditional, and I would argue narrow view of what it means to have impact within research.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that we've come from kind of similarly different backgrounds. So I think when I heard postdocs and early career researchers in my group and related groups talking about how they were assessed, it's very much focused around traditional academic papers. They were feeling that they had to publish these papers. And like you, my research group are very much focused on other kinds of outputs. So we produce software, we produce communications for the public, for patients, for the NHS, for policymakers, none of which lend themselves to being in an academic paper. So we do some primary research, as you were saying, and we do publish that in academic journals. And to start with, that was, for me, mainly to look after the careers of early careers researchers that I was working with. I have now found that actually there are some benefits to having these kinds of citable works that stay around in the research record as well, because things that are reports and those sorts of things can get lost over the number of years, whilst having a place where you can always point to some work and say, this is where it is and this is where it's always going to be, is very useful. But yes, I think one of the problems for research assessment is who gets researched and how they get researched and what they get researched on. But another thing is really, what are we trying to achieve as researchers, and how can you possibly assess that? I mean, what we're all doing is very broad, and the concept of kind of helping the advancement of knowledge is really quite nebulous. So I think there are some sort of fundamentally difficult things, which is probably why we're not doing it brilliantly at the moment.
I think that absolutely nails it with, you know, why are we doing this? So, I mean, ultimately, I see research assessment as being a way of ensuring that, you know, we're spending taxpayers' money in the right way. We're getting the impact that taxpayers deserve for the investment they make in research. And there's lots of other sort of side issues about it, about, you know, if we can identify what works within research, then we can share it. And that means we can, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants and all that sort of philosophy. But I don't think the way that research assessment is set up at the moment is doing that in a way that works within the modern research environment. And I was kind of brought around to this issue. You never get far from talk about research assessment in universities without somebody bringing up the REF, the Research Excellence Framework, because that is the, you know, as somebody who wasn't writing papers myself, every 7 years, the people around me would get very energized by the REF, and I would wonder what was going on. Mm-hmm. So I actually had a look into it back in 2015, 16, because I was interested in how much software was being recognized. I was really, really happy to see that software as an output category is actually recognized in the REF, and it has been in the 2021 REF, the 2014 REF, the 2008 REE, you know, back into the history of research assessment, software has been around. And I had a look at research outputs, which are a significant part of the REF submission. And I found that so although software was there alongside 20 other research categories or research output categories, in the 2014 REF, out of 186,000 outputs that had been submitted by researchers across the university, there was 38 outputs recognized in the software category. This thing that, I mean, without software, you don't have research. Maybe there's a couple of edge cases, but without software, no research and no recognition for this fundamental research tool. And that's when I started to think maybe the way we're doing research assessment doesn't actually assess the real research going on in universities, and it's skewed in a particular direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I mean, the sorts of things that we do, and I was involved with my institution's last REF submissions in terms of impact case studies, because this is another thing that the REF does, is to try and be broader than just looking at the sort of quality of outputs, is looking at the impact. And one of the problems that I had was that each of the impact case studies was supposed to be tied back to a published paper. So you had to be able to track the impact of a particular research paper. And again, if you haven't written the paper, you can't then create an impact case study of the impact of that research, because the research kind of apparently hasn't been done if it hasn't been published as an academic paper. So yes, I had problems with demonstrating usefulness and impact in that way through REF. And I think when we think about evidence communication in my day job, as it were, we look at kind of two main things. One is trustworthiness and one is usefulness. And I think that kind of those two things are really what we're looking for in research. We've got to be able to see whether it's useful to people. And that might not be, you know, all people. It might be your software might be useful to a quite small group of other researchers, but it's useful. And it's trustworthy in that other people can build on it and have trust in it. And for me, that brings up openness as well, which is something that I'm sure we'll talk about a bit more, that to really trust something, you've got to be able to assure yourself that it is doing what you think it's doing. And if you can't necessarily look at it in enough detail, if it's a bit of a black box, then demonstrating that trustworthiness, I think, is difficult. So I think the openness of research to scrutiny is an important part of good research and trustworthy research.
It's really interesting, isn't it, that we all know that openness is important. Well, I think the majority of us at least know that openness is important. Mm-hmm. And we want research to be trusted. And how can we expect research to be trusted if it isn't open and reproducible? Mm-hmm. But the way that we're assessing research is directly tied to that. Because if you assess research based on the number of publications you get out, well, the incentive is get a publication out and get out quick. You want to get out before other people and you want to amass as many publications as is humanly possible, because the more publications, the better your research looks with our current system of research assessment. But we don't actually want that. We want the right results being published. We want emphasis placed on that. And I know there's peer review and the various other sort of standards that go on to make sure that the publications are, you know, conveying the right results. But if you're not giving researchers any recognition for the time they invest into open techniques and the effort that's necessary to make research open, then how can you expect them to value that? Mm. You know, so we should definitely value it as a university, as a society, but we can't expect researchers to value it as much as they should unless we recognize that effort that's invested into openness.
And for me, one of the aspects of that comes to what we recognize as research, really, because, for instance, is it mainly perhaps around the findings that come out of quite a long process of collecting data and doing analysis, or is data itself an output that we should be valuing just as much as conclusions that are drawn from that data? Because I think at the moment we don't have incentives for people to share data, which can be hard won and very difficult to clean up and annotate and make useful for other people, but then incredibly valuable to society and through other researchers working with that data. And I know there are some fields. I was talking to somebody in astronomy recently who was saying, you know, that their data comes from, you know, a particular telescope, and there are people who collect that data and then it's made available and everybody works with that data and does their various research from it. And so their setup of what's recognized is quite different from some other fields where people will, you know, guard their data with their lives almost, because getting that data and keeping that data then gives them a particular stream of publications that they can produce from that data. And I think the way that we incentivize the sharing of different kinds of research output and the emphasis that we put on what some people might think of as different stages of the research process, but others might think of as different kind of careers within the research field, you know, data production being one of them in a particular field, really skews the way that the whole assessment structure and then for the incentive structure and therefore the career pathways are built.
Yeah, I think that this is the problem we're talking about research assessment in my eyes, is you start off by saying, well, the problem is, you know, we're not incentivizing the right kind of practices. And then every single time you peel back a layer, you go, oh, and there are more problems. So, yeah, I think what you were saying there, so like, you know, when we should be incentivizing the share of data or software or, you know, knowledge in general. Mm-hmm. And we're not, because it's very easy to share the result in a publication. It's well understood and it's quite simple to do. Sharing something like data is so difficult, you know, because you have to put so much effort into ensuring that you've described it adequately, that the metadata is up to speed, that it's written to a standard, that it's in a place where, you know, it's shareable and identifiable and all of these sort of things. It's a huge amount of work to do that, but there's no incentive for doing it. So we really, really minimize the amount of data sharing that could be done. And then you realize that it's not being shared also because we don't have the right skills. So there's a whole conversation to be had around the training that research is given. Mm. You know, people turn up for their PhD, They've not been trained in any of these sort of open and reproducible research techniques, and they're suddenly meant to magically acquire them overnight. And then you start saying, well, there are specialists who do this and they're not being recognized, and you open the entire career path and who's recognized for the success in research and trying to bring the right and retain the right kind of skilled people into the research environment. So every single time you look at a research assessment, I find you just find more and more problems. I don't think we'll be able to solve them all in this 1 hour podcast, but I'm willing to give them a shot.
And I've just thought of one other, which is the way in which we share stuff. So, historically, I think we've got stuck with this old piece of text on a piece of paper, which, isn't the way that you share so much. Well, it isn't the best way to share data or code or any of these other things. And I think there's probably a lot of historical overhang so that we're stuck with papers and PDFs and all of these historical artifacts, really, and that assessment and the general culture hasn't necessarily caught up with modern research techniques.
So I think the culture is where it gets really interesting. Mm. So my feeling when I first started out in this area was that I would get quite a lot of pushback from saying, well, we should change publications. I don't think they're up to scratch for modern research techniques. There are other things that we should do. But I've not come across that really. I mean, there's a couple of people who have pushed back because they're kind of set in their ways. But largely, I've found that the people I talk to, both, obviously within the Hidden Ref community, people are very open to it. But just in general research conferences and things that I attend, people are open to changing the way that we conduct research so that we can have a more adequate system of research assessment put in place that puts value on these things we've been discussing about on career paths and on sharing and collaboration. And I think it's because they can see the benefit of that, but they're stuck in this research culture that makes it incredibly difficult to try and strike out on your own and say, I'm not going to care about publications. I'm going to work on collaborations and make my impact in a different way. Mm. So it all comes back to changing that research culture. And that's where I'm going to come back to the REF again. I think the REF has a really important role to play in changing the research culture by incentivizing the right behaviors. And I have to say that I think Research England are absolutely on the right track with this. They seem very keen to incentivize the behaviors that we think are important to advance research rather than in the behaviors that we've accepted and got used to.
I absolutely agree. So in my sort of journey through this, I've come up to the same point, which is, it's relatively easy to think of better ways to do things. But the problem is that even though people agree with you, they all think that they can't change the system and they all think that somebody else has the control. And what really frustrates me is that it's not like we're fighting the rules of physics here. The people that have control over the system is in fact kind of all of us. And there is no kind of external control to the system. It's all internal. So it's a solvable problem. It may be a complex problem and it involves culture and a lot of people in a lot of very different fields and disciplines working in different ways. But as you say, there are bodies like those in control of REF who have enormous amounts of power. But also, it's not just those powerful bodies. It's everybody who is hiring and promoting. It's every funder. It's every institution. So I think everybody should feel that they have a role to play in changing. And it is a bit chicken and egg. So I speak to quite a lot of funders and people in charge of policy who say, oh, if researchers started doing this or that, then we would absolutely support them and follow them. And researchers are saying, well, I can't do this and that because my institution and my funder doesn't support me. And so I think we have all got to sort of hold hands and take a step together, that there is a moment. But it does feel, and I've came to academia and towards the end of 2016, and I felt the momentum over the last few years that change is happening, and it is happening quite fast. So I do have huge optimism that, this next REF is going to be another step change, and that other countries around the world are making similar changes, and that institutions are open, and funders are certainly open to changes in the way that they assess and incentivize work as well. So I am optimistic, but maybe it would be good for you to talk a bit about HiddenRef and why you came up with the idea of HiddenRef and what you're doing with it now.
Absolutely. It's my favorite subject. So HiddenRef came about because of that work I did with the ref results. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Why are we putting around about 98% of raw research outputs go into publications, basically books or journal papers? And I thought about all of the work that I've done. I'm very lucky to work across disciplines. So I get an experience of a wide range of different research sort of cultures and philosophies and methodologies. And I could see that just publications wasn't going to recognize a significant amount of people that I was working with. And I thought, well, something has to change here. And I thought, at the time, the ref was just kicking off, and it's the perfect foil for a campaign because it seems that most people hate the ref, even the ones who are helped by the ref. So I thought, well, this is a good thing. So let's do the HiddenRef, and let's look at all of the things that aren't being recognized by the standard sort of approach. And so we put up a website. At that stage, it was me putting up a website. But then instantly, a ton of people got involved. All volunteers came onto the committee and have been running the entire campaign alongside me. We have now, I think it's 11 people on the committee, and we have a huge community of people who are following us and provide support in various different ways. And what really occurred to me was that we thought, well, let's run a competition for these hidden research outputs. The first thing that occurred was that people kept wanting to submit people rather than other outputs. So alongside the software and the data and all the other things I cared about, there was people coming in. And I realized that was the first time that the hidden role that I was really closely aligned to, the research software engineer, that was just one of many, many different ways that people were contributing to research and not being recognized. So all of these new roles sort of came out of the woodwork for me. And we ran the competition. By far the most popular category was these hidden roles. It was won by a technician, I should point out. So just so you know that all of these hidden roles, some of them have been around as long as there's been research. So it's not a new problem. It's an old problem. And then because people got so engaged with it, myself and the committee were talking about, well, what do we do next? And we thought, well, let's run it as a campaign. It's not something that's going to change overnight. This is going to be a number of ref cycles until we see significant change. Unfortunately, I hate to tell you that, but I think it's that kind of long-term thinking we're going for. So now we're running a campaign and we're doing various things. We had a festival in September, which was amazing. We had a ton of people come together talking about what could change. But we're also starting to look at particular elements of the assessment process we'd like to change. And the big one for us at the moment is the 5% manifesto, we're calling it. And that is for REF 2029, the next REF. We want universities, other HEIs, to sign up to promise to submit at least 5% of their outputs, their research outputs, into what we call non-traditional categories, so non-publication categories. And if we can get that done, I think that will be a first step towards changing that culture around research assessment, and hopefully will open the doors to even greater changes.
So have you got a website where you are naming institutions that have signed up to the 5% manifesto? How does that work?
So we have got a website and we are naming institutions. We are naming the institutions that do sign up and not the ones that don't.
Right.
So that's on the HiddenRef website, which you can just search for HiddenRef and it's up there and called the 5% manifesto. You can also sign up to it as an individual.
Oh.
We're really interested in getting people signed up because we want to show the groundswell of support for this concept. One of the big questions we get asked about the 5% manifesto was like, why so low? Because 5% isn't much of a percentage. But the current average into non-traditional output categories is 2.4%. So we're asking people to double the average.
Yeah.
And it also has this lovely little sort of hook to that campaign, which is if we can't persuade universities to submit only 5% of their outputs into non-traditional categories, well, that shows how dyed in the wool this approach to research assessment is and just quite how fundamentally important publications are still in the minds of HEIs.
I'm scrolling down your webpage now to see the people that have signed up. And as you say, quite a lot signing up for themselves.
Yes.
which is a really interesting thing. So if you're listening to this podcast, I guess you can go along and sign yourself up, or possibly sign your institution up.
I deeply encourage you to do so, but don't sign up your institution unless you've got their permission.
May I ask a quick question around the Hidden Ref and how well Research England and those sort of in charge of the Ref are hearing what the Hidden Ref are aiming for with the 5% manifesto?
So I can't speak for Research England, but the response that we've had when we've been talking to policymakers from Research England has been very, very positive. And largely there has been I've certainly come away with the sense that they are very keen on changing the way that research assessment is conducted. I mean, why would they have so many output categories for so long if they weren't keen on them being used? And my personal feeling is that, you know, it's a struggle to get the HEIs to listen to this broader way of assessing research, unless you start incentivizing it very heavily. You know, one of the things I was talking about was saying, why can't we have a threshold for non-traditional outputs? Why can't we have a particular focus on non-traditional outputs in the environment statement and all manner of other ways of basically forcing HEIs to think about it? And obviously, that's not the way that things are done. I was told the other day that, you know, when talking about this, you know, I'm not so sure that we should be relying on the stick rather than the carrot. And I don't know if I agree with that. I think occasionally when practices are so embedded as they are now, you need a bit of stick. But my general impression from Research England is that they are very open to this kind of broader way of interpreting research, and they are highly supportive.
One of the concerns that I've heard about non-traditional outputs, I hate using that term, but you know what I mean, is the way that they might be assessed by peers. And I've heard people expressing concerns about they don't know enough about whether what they're submitting is going to score highly, and a lot, you know, rides on people's submissions to the Ref. So I wondered what you normally say to people around that. And actually, I've got some thoughts and questions about how you at Hidden Ref assess these very broadly variable outputs as well.
Yes. So it is the big question. So I think my first response whenever asked that question is, you know, it's very easy to constantly look at the difficulties of changing research assessment. So just let's remind ourselves of what we get if we can do it. And what we get if we can do it is we will be recognizing every single person and every single thing that's important to research. Not important as in it's nice to recognize, but without it, there would be no research. We were talking about software earlier on. You know, without software, no research. So if we can come up with an assessment system and get over these problems, we will build a system of research that could do so much more with the same amount of resources. We could significantly advance research because we'd be incentivizing everybody who's involved in research and helping them do their work, keeping the best people in academia and identifying and sharing the best practices and outputs. So that's the promise, right? And we could be the first country in the world to do that. It could be a huge boost for UK research. That's the prize. We have some problems to get over before we get there, right? But there's a reason to get over these problems. The big one, as you say, is what do I do when I get, you know, I've got this research output that's a bit of software and I've got this musical composition. How am I going to compare, you know, the relative weighting on impact on these two things? That actual comparison wouldn't happen because they're different panels, but you will have to compare, say, software and data or something along those lines. And my argument to that is I think we've just got so used to having research papers as our research-focused sort of output that, and it's easy to just count them. You know, you can look at which journals have been published in if you want to have an idea of whether they're how important they are. People hear that when I say it, but that is what happens. You know, you can do that. So they're nice countable metrics. But the rest of the world has to get by without having countable metrics. The rest of the world has to, you know, work out whether, you know, this operation went well and helped somebody with a slight problem, and this one, though it didn't go so well, but it was a significant health risk for the society at large. You know, there's lots of different times we have these really subjective things to compare. We can find a way through it. And I think part of the way that we find our way through it is by practicing. So we certainly can't do it if we don't have any guidance. We don't look at the issue in any way, shape, or form, and we don't talk to the experts. And that's what the Hidden Ref's doing now. We're getting the experts together around these different fields, getting them talking about how they compare the relative merits of the outputs and the people that are of interest to them. We're writing that up, and we're going to share it with ref panels, with research managers within universities, and with researchers as a whole. And I think at that point, you start to build a system that can cope with these, comparing these disparate outputs. But the thing that won't work is just complaining about it and then never doing anything about it, which has been largely the approach that we've taken up to the current date. Is that too harsh? The thing I'm really interested in is the tools that are helping people understand their outputs and share them and things. And Octopus is one of those key tools. So I'm really interested in hearing how that fits into the research assessment conversation.
Yeah, I think initially when I came up with the idea about Octopus, it wasn't focused necessarily around research assessment. I was thinking about, as you said, how the traditional paper is not necessarily the best way for us to share what we've done, our work, especially not in all its glorious detail and in full open form so that other people can use it. And I was thinking to break down the concept of a paper into smaller units, which are not necessarily all done by the same person, or possibly even by, they could be done by different groups, different people at different times in different places in the world, and kind of trying to change the way that we think about collaboration and working together and our place and our career within the research landscape. So I could, for example, be a specialist in analysis of astronomical data, say, and I can go out into the world of data out there and analyze it and publish my analyses without having to be part of a research collaboration or a group that always work together, that somebody else is collecting the data and then I am analyzing it sort of with and for them, and that we would wait till the end of that process before sharing any of it as a research paper, which then wouldn't necessarily contain all the different bits that somebody who wanted to reuse or assess that work would need, the code, the raw data, all of that. So Octopus was designed to break down the concept of a paper in order to make sharing faster, to make it more collaborative, and to make it more kind of 21st century, essentially. But I also then thought, well, the way that you assess a paper, it's the analogy to what I was doing when I was working in the film world really kind of struck me, because in the media, what you're doing is the communication is everything and the effect on the audience is everything. And so it makes sense if I am being assessed to ask the audience, you enter a film festival and the audience will vote on whether your film was emotionally engaging and effective and all of these kinds of things. And so we have really good metrics in the media world based on what we're trying to achieve. And then I looked at kind of the metrics for papers, and I thought they kind of seem to be going the same way as the metrics for the media world in, how many people read this? How many people cited this? Did they feel that it was an effective communication? Those metrics are not really getting at what research is trying to do, which is, generate knowledge. It's all about the content, not about the communication. And so all of these thoughts made me think, well, maybe we should be assessing things differently. And if we are separating the research paper into different smaller units, actually that allows much more granular assessment. You can assess what this particular person is doing when they're collecting the data. Is this good data? Is it robust? Is it well annotated? Is it reusable? All of these different aspects could be assessed by another specialist. So peer review, when I peer review a paper, I'm being asked to assess many different aspects of that paper's work, some of which I may not feel so confident of assessing. So I will always turn down the opportunity to peer review a paper that's got a large quantitative component, because I know that my quantitative skills are not up to assessing that, which, you know, limits the number of papers that I can assess. But I'm being asked to assess every part of that research paper. And research papers can have huge amounts of different work within them. And if you're not able to assess each of those parts, then really you can't assess the whole. And so it seems to me that breaking up the paper and communicating things in smaller bits allows more focused peer review of particular aspects of the work. And if we can guarantee the robustness of all the smaller pieces of the work, then in a way we are kind of, as an emergent property, guaranteeing a greater robustness of all the findings and the things that will emerge out of that sort of foundational bits of research work. So that's how I think Octopus maybe feeds into this, because our research outputs are all what you would call non-traditional. They're not papers, and they allow this more granular assessment. And what I'm interested in the difference between maybe REF as well as Octopus and Hidden REF is that, as I understand it, everything in Hidden REF is a competition. So you're literally saying one thing is better than another. You're not both saying they're both excellent. Is that true? And how do you square that?
Oh, I square that with great difficulty is what I do. The problem is, what I would like to do is let's get recognition for everything. And certainly we try to do that. So everybody who submits into the Hidden REF, they basically are recognized. We try and get their name out there. They get a certificate to put up on the wall and all these sort of things to say that this is, this output or this person is important to research. The problem is a practical one. How do you get other people interested in that? And it's largely, and then the way we solve that is by running a competition. And we have had pushback. People have said, you know, isn't that just having this sort of elitist angle on this is the best stuff and this is the stuff you don't need to think about? Mm-hmm. I don't entirely agree with that, to be honest with you, but I do see the point. So we are currently thinking about the next competition, which, you know, we're only starting to plan now and should take place later on this year. And how can we get around that problem of trying to recognize everybody's work, show that everybody's work is important, but also do it in a way that is exciting and interesting and will get people to come and look and get people to come and submit? I don't know what the answer is yet. Mm-hmm. I have to say on Octopus, though, I think this one of the problems that we've come across a lot, which isn't related to Hidden REF, and in fact is related to things like my work with software and data, is that, you know, people don't share because it's difficult to disentangle all the different parts of their project, you know, and the thing that they know they're going to share, the publication at the end, they get that out. And then the data and the software and all the other sharing happens sort of after that point, and usually with quite a lot of retrospective cleaning and tidying up and stuff. So mm-hmm. So having a tool that helps you do that from the beginning, I think is absolutely the right way to do it. You know, all of my software development is done under open development techniques. So we start, you know, everything's open from day one. I really think any tool that helps researchers do that is important, not just because it incentivizes the behavior, but it also allows you to sort of, you know, demarcate. This is the software bit of the research project. This is the data bit. This is the, you know, this is the methodology and the even, I think if I remember correctly, you can do like your initial thoughts and just your aspirations and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think having that demarcation between those different sections is really helpful, because then you can go, I want to share this bit of it. I mean, I often produce clean data sets that I'm desperately trying to give to other people to do analysis because I don't have the time to do the analysis myself.
Yep.
So having that is such a powerful tool. And I think it also, when it comes to the peer review side of things, it shows what things are missing. And, you know, when I get asked to review papers, I'll often get asked to review a paper and there's no software or data. And you think, well, I can kind of say that this result looks right, but I have no way of verifying that. Like, there's zero way. I mean, this is me guessing, basically. And I think a lot of people would admit to that if more people would admit to that if it was a better known factor. That basically you can't fully assess a paper often unless you have access to all of those underlying components to the research. That's why I think the tools like Octopus are really important.
I've been very impressed by some reviewers who have asked for data and code and rerun our analysis code, checked it all. And I think, yeah, that's how a review should work.
It is.
But you've got to allow that.
Got to allow it. It takes a huge amount of time as well, which then takes us into, I was talking about this layered onion problem of research assessment. That takes you into why aren't peer reviewers being paid and all these sort of issues.
Yeah.
So that's for another day, I think.
Well, I was going to say, between us, there are a lot of potential solutions here, but the one thing that we both agree on is this big cultural change that needs to happen. What are your thoughts about how different people within the community can help with this cultural change? I mean, listening to you, it reminds me how strong the influence of, a PI leading a team can be, because you say, as your team members are starting out on a project, don't forget to make sure that all your code is commented and keep it up to date. And you can institute all of these habits in early career researchers, and that influence can be really strong. How can we encourage, do you think, this will just flow through the culture, this change will flow through, or how can people encourage the change to happen more quickly?
It's really difficult, isn't it? So often what we'll do is we'll focus on early career researchers and we'll say, right, well, they're the people who are coming in. Mm-hmm. They are yet to be set in their ways, so they're flexible and they'll be open to these new ways of working. And I think, yeah, they often are, in my experience at least. Early career researchers, working with them, they're the ones who are like, this doesn't work. I'm not going to start my entire career based on this broken methodology. I'm going to change it. So I think they have that promise of being able to change the way things are done. But what they don't have, is the power usually, and they are more, mm-hmm. They're having to listen to what they're told to do more than maybe some of us who have been around for a bit longer have to do. So they are restricted at the same time. I think sometimes too much pressure is put on the early career researchers to be the instigators of change, because they're fighting again in a system where early career researchers are not valued as highly as they should be. We still have this sort of, hero scientist or hero researcher view or culture within universities where, the person at the top of the chain gets to do what they want and everybody else has to jump. So I think early career researchers, huge amount of promise, but we shouldn't put too much pressure on them of being the instigators for change. And then, so I think you're right with the PIs that they are the ones who can say, well, from now on, I want this practice to be changed. So we have to focus on them as well. The issue with them is getting the time with them. Workloads are so incredibly high in academia that, you may desperately want to change the way things are done. You may want to learn more about it, but you rarely get enough time to actually go in and investigate something new and exciting. So that's where you've got to have this relationship, this good relationship between your researchers who are earlier in their career and the PIs who are established and have the power to get things changed. So I very much think that's a group dynamic that is the way that we will change things in the future. Then, there's all these different... One of my problems with academia is power is spread so incredibly thinly. There's so many people are involved in decision-making that actually getting something to change, it's like trying to move, trying to change the course of an oil tanker, but with the oil tanker having about 100 different captains who won't talk to each other. So it's so hard in academia to get that to change. So I think the sort of the strategic leaders, the sort of people in charge, the VCs and the VPs, the deans and all that, have this incredibly important part as well to allow the change to happen, to sort of say, we are open to change. We can see the benefit in what will happen if we can get this right. We're not going to be cynical and say, oh, we tried that in the 70s and it didn't work. Right? We are going to be open-minded to it and to allow then the research groups themselves to start putting together the dynamic that I was talking about that will allow that change to happen.
Yeah.
When you're changing research culture, this is the problem. Everybody has a part to play and they're all equally important, unfortunately. That's why it's so difficult to change.
I do think that maybe the funders have perhaps the strongest role, because so many researchers that I talk to say, if the funder tells me to do something, I have to do it. They are my funder. So maybe the funders have a slightly stronger hold on the wheel than anybody else. What do you think?
Yeah, there is definitely truth to that. Welcome, quite a few years back, maybe a couple of decades back, they changed the way that they dealt with open software. They changed the policy. They did it in a really good way, wrote the policy, released it, everybody could see it, told them when things were going to change. Things changed, and suddenly, you know, this more open approach to software was taken, you know, across all welcome funding. Mm-hmm. So you have that power that you can change. I think the UKRI funders, the research councils under the UKRI, have more restrictions on the way that they can change, I think, because there's more feedback between senior management in universities and UKRI management. So they can't just impose changes like the foundations can. I think there has to be more of a consensus for that change to come in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. I think they've got a really important role to play. Certainly when we've seen funders do things like, so to go back to research software engineering again, one of the really important changes that happened that got the concept of research software engineering into universities was that the EPSRC ran a fellowship for RSEs. And suddenly institutions could get a reasonable chunk of money to support somebody doing a job that they knew was important. And all they needed to do was write a letter of support that said that that person would be supported for years afterwards. And that broke open more doors in universities to research software engineering than many of the other things we did. So I think, yeah, funders have a huge role to play, but they can't do it alone.
So what are we going to do to change the world quickly then?
Changing the world quickly, let me see. So changing the world quickly is something that I have found that doesn't happen. When we first launched the Software Sustainability Institute in 2010, I remember people saying, so, you know, how long will it take to get software sort of recognized as a first-class research output? Will you get it done in the first 5 years? And I was thinking, no. You don't want to say no, but no, it's not going to happen. It's going to take a long time. And I would suggest that we are looking at a next couple of ref cycles for this to happen.
Really?
The other day I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, am I still going to be working? You know, mm. I'm not at the end of my career yet, but a couple of ref cycles is quite far away.
Yeah.
So I think we have, rather than thinking about the final change when everything's in place and it's all working perfectly, as I'm sure it will do at some point in the future, what I think we need to be thinking about is what iterative changes that will make the world a slightly better place can we get into position?
Yeah.
And I think the next obvious barrier for that is 2029 with the RET submission. And I think the changes that we can get into place, one of them has been instigated by Research England already, which is any staff member, doesn't have to be an academic, can submit outputs. Mm. So I want to see lots of people, lots of universities submitting outputs that have been generated by non-academic staff or a combination of academic and non-academic staff, mm-hmm. right? And also non-traditional outputs, mm-hmm. the number of those that we can get in. I'd love to see more than 5%, but I'll take 5% because that's in the name of the manifesto. I'd like to see about 50, but I don't think that's going to be happening. But for me, those two changes are the first steps to more towards making this better world that we're discussing. What about yourself?
Well, I think I kind of initially thought, well, the first thing we need to do is to come up with a better way, and then we need to build that better way. So, you know, Octopus was designed to restructure the incentive system to provide a basis for a better way of doing research sharing and research assessment. So it's now possible to do it that way. And now we need to make it easy to do it that way and then encourage people to do it that way. And I think hopefully, you know, it is a way of people creating more widely recognized non-traditional research outputs. So we could work with both REF and Hidden REF as a way for people to submit to REF and Hidden REF their non-traditional outputs. So I think there's some good working together we can do there. But I always like things to move faster than a glacial timescale. So I'm hoping that we can improve the culture year on year, really, and get things changing faster than two more ref cycles.
I hope you're right. I'm deeply optimistic about the people, but I'm not deeply optimistic about the institutions. So I think, yeah, I'm being cynical and pessimistic. I'm really looking forward to being proven wrong.
great, let's prove you wrong.
So Alex, Simon, thank you. That was really interesting to hear your conversations around research assessment and the sheer complexity, I think, of kind of making any change to what research assessment looks like now and perhaps how we'd like it to look in the future. And I think certainly a takeaway for me is that everybody has a role to play in making that change. So thanks again for joining today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.